Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 275, recorded for the week of September 10th, 2024. I scream, you scream, we all scream for AI ice cream. Good evening.
Is it Matt delicious?
I don't know. It tastes like hopes and dreams of AI startups. So, you know, possibly not. I don't know. All right. Well, we got a busy show this week, so we should jump right into it. First up, AWS, once again. If you are like the CloudPod host and you like to generate lots of funny images and memes using AI, which is our primary use case here, luckily, AWS has your back this week with the latest image generation capability with three models from Stability AI. The Stable Image Ultra, which produces the highest quality photorealistic outputs perfect for professional print media and large format applications. The Stable Image Ultra excels at rendering exceptional detail and realism. The Stable Diffusion 3 Large strikes a balance between generation speed and output quality, ideal for creating high volume, high quality digital assets for websites, newsletters, and marketing materials. And Stable Image Core, optimized for fast and affordable image generation, great for rapidly iterating on concepts during ideation. A couple details about these. The Ultra has 16 billion parameters, the Large has 8 billion, and the Stable Image Core has 2.6 billion parameters available to. Inputs for all three of these are text. The Stable Diffusion 3 Large also accepts an image. So if you're trying to give it an image to base your new image off of, like Ryan, for example, is a profile photo you might use for that, you could pass that into it and then have it modify Ryan into becoming a Frankenstein type creature, because it is Halloween season, you know, very soon. So one of the key improvements for Stable Image Ultra and Stable Diffusion 3 Large compared to Stable Diffusion XL, which is the prior version, is text quality and generated images with fewer errors in spelling and typography, which all I can say is thank you, goodness, because that's my number one pet peeve, is trying to add text to a generated image and have it literally take the word I gave you and then misspell it.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that that has been improved.
What do they mean by like high volume, high quality digital assets? Like, are they, is the expectation you're going to like generate a different one for like so many requests? Like, that seems kind of a crazy. Yeah.
Maybe you want something for like, you know, the web page versus a billboard, you know, so you want your more pixels in one versus the other.
Well, I could see maybe perhaps in the Amazon world where you would have, you know, you're uploading a large number of SKUs that you'd like to get AI images generated for very quickly, that you might want to be able to do them in high volume and get high quality assets out of it.
Yeah.
So I do notice more and more that, you know, you get the typical product shot on Amazon, but then like they'll insert the product into different backgrounds and scenes, like, oh, it's a lamp, and all of a sudden it's on a thing, and they're like, that doesn't look like real photo though. It looks like AI. So you do notice it more and more.
You know, I do find it funny every time we're making it generate a picture of something silly, or one of our co-hosts, you know, we'll have to do one for Jonathan to shame him properly.
His nap that he took 20 minutes before the show. He's like, I'll take a quick nap, and then lost to us forever.
It's gone forever.
Mattress gods fickle.
I do laugh. You know, this, the most I use AI for is that. So it's, try not to think about, like, you know, all the hundreds of thousands of servers churning over.
Yeah, you think about all the carbon you're emitting into the to the atmosphere to generate that image, and you're like, well, you know, there's these things that aren't so great.
It's like the olden days when there was like every Google search was X, you know, number of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, and now you're like every AI is 12x that, and we still do it every day for fun. Mm-hmm.
I see you, Amazon, trying to get two press releases for basically the same darn thing. Not today, sir. Not today. Both the AWS Network Load Balancer and the Gateway Load Balancer have received configurable TCP timeouts. And they're so identical, in fact, that you could just do a simple words replacement for this press release. They both have a fixed value previously of 350 seconds, which could cause apparently TCP handshake retries for long-lived traffic flows on the Network Load Balancer or on the Gateway Load Balancer. It could cause other disruptions to your application. But now you can configure between 60 seconds and 6,000 seconds, with the default remaining at 350 for backwards compatibility. Again, like 6,000 seconds seems like a really long time, but you know, you do you.
Yeah. Well, we've all worked at that company with that one ancient app that, you know, couldn't handle.
Yep.
retries.
But 100 minutes, though, that's quite a while.
Yeah, it sure is.
The one thing it really does show you, if you didn't know it in advance, was the network load balancer, or sorry, the gateway load balancer is built off the network load balancer. So at least it's, some ways, Amazon eating their own dog food and, actually building stuff on top of other services.
Yeah. But some product manager got 2 press releases out of this and was like, yes, I'm 2 press releases closer to my goal for the year. For basically the same darn thing.
Yeah. Hopefully it's also 2 bullet points on their, end of the year review.
No, it's going to be 2 full OKRs, I'm sure. The AWS Fault Injection Service now provides additional safety control with a safety lever that, when engaged, stops all running experiments and prevents new experiments from starting. You can also prevent fault injection during certain time periods, such as sales events or product launches, or in response to application health alarms. And I was thinking about this. I was like, my operational side says, yes, I'm going to set that to not run any fault injection at night so it doesn't wake me up when it fails. And then my executive side said, no, you can't do that at night. You can't do it during the day and impact production. So my 2 halves of my operational side and my executive side are at conflict on this one, but I appreciate the capability.
Yeah, I was in my head, I immediately went to like, oh, something bad happened that caused this feature to exist. Like, oh, I feel bad for whoever that was. Because it wasn't good.
That's where my head went too.
Hopefully it was Amazon during testing for Prime Day, not a customer. And then I won't feel so bad about it.
That's true. Prime Day went off without a hitch. So,
I'm just imagining someone being like, cool, let's enable this and not really actually looking at what they enabled and taking down production and then like screaming at my Azure or AWS for like taking down like an ECS cluster or something. So,
you type out something in the Terraform code and created, 3,000 copies of the same injection attempt, and then you're causing them. So stop all of them.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate it.
Yeah.
You can now run petabyte scale data analytics and machine learning on EMR serverless direct from SageMaker Studio Notebooks. Serverless automatically provisions and scales the needed resources to take care of your terrible query, allowing you to focus on data models without having to configure, optimize, tune, or manage your cluster, which is very appreciated by me because anytime I get into doing heavy-duty Spark and EMR work, I'm just like, oh, yeah, big data. Mm-hmm. Kill me now.
Yeah, is it the query that's terrible or the underlying data?
Or both.
Or both.
It's both.
That's Schrodinger's query. You have no idea. I can make a show title.
Yeah.
Agents for Amazon Bedrock enable developers to create generative AI-based applications that can complete complex tasks for a wide range of use cases and deliver answers based on compatible company knowledge sources using Sonnet 3.5 and the Bedrock Agent RAG capabilities. Woo.
Yay.
Yeah. Yay, AI. Not having using Bedrock or Bedrock agents, like I'm a little like, cool. What? But I'm trying to figure out like what the equivalent is. But I imagine it's just
an AI bot you put onto your Slack team that answers questions based on data you fed it, basically.
All right, so it's not
agents is really just a chat interface to an AI of some kind that you fed data to.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So it's cool.
Because I was you 3 weeks ago. Not really knowing what Bedrock Agents was. So I had to do some Googling and some research.
That's why we keep you around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. If you're leveraging Amazon Workspace pools powered by either Windows 10 or 11, you can now bring your own license, assuming you meet certain Microsoft requirements, which include handing over buckets of money, to support your eligible M365 apps for enterprise, providing a consistent desktop experience to their users when they switch between on-premise and virtual desktops. I don't ever worked in a place where I had a virtual desktop and an on-premise desktop that I could switch between, but for the same use case. But I have one for dev. But that's a different thing.
I doubt they're talking about a single user. I think it's like if you're an IT department, you have to manage both.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes more sense than my interpretation. So.
And just the fact that like they're still adding, all these licensing things shows how complicated Microsoft licensing is and how you're, I'm sure, violating it, even if you're actually trying not to, but.
That's the thing about Microsoft licensing. You never really know if you're violating it or not. You think you got it right, but you're audit paperwork comes, you're still, oh no.
Yeah.
Even though I think I did it completely right, I'm not sure. Because something changed that you didn't know about, which is also the worst.
I almost feel like there needs to be like, I am try. Does that count? Like, give me 20% off this.
Well, normally that's like, I think when you get caught in, I mean, I've never been audited that way, and I don't ever hope to be. But you know, if you are in the situation and you get, you know, I think you get a chance to try to remediate it and address the issue before it becomes a big problem. But I don't know. As long as you're willing to pay money to Microsoft, I'm sure they'll make it go away. It's basically the net of that conversation.
Microsoft, Oracle. Sorry, I got the wrong name.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Either one is fine. And then, you know, the Oracle case, they'll throw in OCI credits for you. And so you're now an OCI customer.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Amazon ECS now supports AWS Graviton-based compute with AWS Fargate Spot. This capability helps you run fault-tolerant ARM-based applications up to a 70% discount compared to Fargate prices. And like, now we're really getting complicated. So now we have Fargate, which is only runs occasionally with your task, on top of a Spot instance that can only run sometimes on a Graviton, which is a proprietary chip from Amazon. So I appreciate this, but man, it's turtles all the way down.
I mean, all this means is that they finally got their inventory up on Graviton, you know, hardware in the data centers where they can start, you know,
allowing it to work. I was actually thinking about that the other day, and I was like, you know, it's interesting because, you know, all these new GPU-based servers have all these empty process, you know, all these processors that they attach to it, like, you know, 192 vCPUs, but you get one H100 or A100 or whatever NVIDIA chip of the day it is. And I'm wondering, like, I bet Spot's a lot of those compute nodes that just are doing nothing because everyone's using the GPU and not using the CPU on those boxes. So thanks NVIDIA and AI Craze. You've really helped out the Spot market for us. So we appreciate that.
I mean, I haven't seen the Spot market go down enough to make that make sense, but hopefully.
I have seen the Spot market be a little bit tighter, where I've definitely lost more things now than I have in the past. Mm-hmm. Just because I think they're also running the regions a little bit tighter. You know, like the airline's not flying half empty planes anymore.
Yeah.
They are 95% full no matter what.
Yeah, whatever their previous threshold was, you know, we want to have this percentage of spare capacity. That was chopped down just a little bit to tighten up CapEx, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, and it just never really came back after the supply chain issues, right? Like,
AWS announced about a couple months ago GenAI Lofts, and I kept meaning to talk about it with you guys. So pre-pandemic, in the before times when Amazon cared about, you know, lift and shift data center migrations, you could go to the Amazon Loft in San Francisco. I think there's one in Seattle, maybe one in New York as well. Where you go in, you could talk to an expert. They held community events, startup events, and it was a really nice thing to get one-on-one assistance on anything you're trying to do in the cloud project. And then, you know, during pandemic, they all disappeared. But they've been brought back sort of with the GenAI Loft. These are not permanent lofts, though. They're just pop-up events typically hosted out of Amazon offices. Currently, there's one in San Francisco and Sao Paulo, Brazil, with London, Paris, and Seoul opening up in October through the month of November. So you can get out there to learn all your AI things. And these are pretty cool. Actually, I was looking at it yesterday when I was prepping this part of the article for us. So in San Francisco, which goes through the end of September, they have a two-day Gen AI bootcamp that they're doing there. They've got a startup event coming up really quick. So if you're looking for some community around cloud and Gen AI efforts, you know, check out one of these lofts if they're coming to a city near you. I assume we'll hear about new ones for next year coming from reInvent if this was successful. If not, then we'll never hear about it again. But, you know, appreciate that it's an option.
Today I learned that the previous lofts were permanent. I thought they were just sort of pop-up events in the same way, just in a more dedicated space.
I mean, they were definitely leased to Amazon for at least a year. So, I mean, I think most of them, you know, were there for multiple years. They moved the one in San Francisco from one place to another at one point. Mm-hmm. But like the one that's in Amazon right now is in, you know, 525 Market, which is their primary AWS office in San Francisco. So yeah, they're taking advantage of the office space is not being filled by employees.
Yeah. I just thought it was like, I didn't realize you could walk in and get, I thought it was just for those events. That's pretty crazy. That's cool. Yep. They should do that more.
They should. I think Google and Azure should get on it too, because I think it's nice to be able to go someplace and get, you know, A, talk to people who are trying to do the same thing you're trying to do. And number two, if they don't know, then you can ask the expert who's there and he can get the answer for you because they're the experts. And they have access to the product managers and different things. And so the Amazon pop-up loft was a lot of fun, especially when I worked in the city because it wasn't that far from my office. And so, you know, go over there after work. They had a beer. You could talk to the person about what you've been trying to figure out all day at work that wasn't working. Like, I'm trying to do this thing and it doesn't work. And what am I doing wrong? And they'd be like, oh, you need to do this or that. It was handy. Yeah. Amazon MSK Replicator now supports a new configuration that enables you to preserve original Kafka topic names while replicating streaming data across Amazon managed streaming for Kafka clusters. Amazon MSK Replicator is a feature of Amazon MSK that lets you reliably replicate data across MSK clusters in the same or different AWS regions with just a few clicks. And the fact that you couldn't use the same topic name between clusters in different regions, that's bad.
Yep.
So glad they fixed this particular problem. Don't know how you missed the memo on that, because that's the number one use case of Mirror Maker between different regions.
I just shut down a little bit when you said Mirror Maker. I cried a little bit on the inside.
Yeah, this is one of those things that they announced it and you're like, oh, you couldn't use them. So, you know, I'm sure people have just been working around this with like application config based off of, you know, where the workload's hosted.
Yeah, you like do a lookup. Like if you're looking into the AZ, you know, region, do AZ dash topic name or topic name dash AZ. Like I'm sure people had terrible workarounds for this. Yeah.
I've done that workaround so many times with so many different like bucket names and instance names and everything to make things work cross region and not hard coding stuff.
When you realize the bucket namespace is global and not just your company, it does burn you pretty quickly.
Luckily, there's very few services that are global like that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to get away with a bucket called public. That's not going to happen for you.
I kind of want to try that now. Like try like bucket one.
Nice.
Public bucket one.
Just do it in a for loop and increment one. See what number you is the first one.
If you had really good bucket names, you think you could auction them off, like sell them like domain names?
Ooh.
Coordinate deletion and just tell them to retry every minute. Yeah. You know, most of the time you can get them back within like a couple minutes. But I have seen it take up to like a day for like to reallocate the name.
Yeah, if you could maybe you could just get support to transfer to a different account, it might be easier. Safer.
Well then you end up with the issue that the guy had a few months ago where he used the name that everybody uses and got charged. Oh,
that's right. The guy who
charged the boatload.
AWS is announcing that EKS is now supported in Amazon SageMaker HyperPods. This purpose-built infrastructure is engineering with resilience at its core for foundational model development. This allows customers to orchestrate HyperPod clusters using EKS, combining the power of Kubernetes with HyperPod's resilient environment designed for training those large models. This was announced apparently 2 years ago at reInvent, and I went in one ear and out the other because I did not remember what HyperPods were, save my life. But it's great that you built something super resilient for foundation model development. Couldn't build that for something else, huh?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, historically these type of jobs haven't been really designed with resilience, right? So it's like you could have a failure and then you have to restart a job or a series of jobs. It's going to take hours to complete. So it is kind of nice to see this, but it is kind of funny. Like, I mean, although I hope that this wasn't caused by a whole bunch of customer interruption. Sounds bad.
Why are they going to run out on Spot?
Yeah, your foundational model on Spot. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Yeah, perfect. Right, let's move on to GCP. First up, Google was apparently named a leader in the Forrester Wave, which is cool. And I was, you know, looking at this of how they, you know, what Forrester had to say about them. And then I noticed the number one leader in this Forrester Wave is Palantir. And I had to ask the question, should we be concerned that Palantir is number one? According to the Forrester Wave, Palantir apparently has one of the strongest offerings in the AI ML space, vision and roadmap to create a platform that brings together humans and machines in a joint decision-making model, which sounds bad. Thoughts?
It's more confusing to me because I just don't hear about them ever. And so it's in the AI ML space, like that's even crazy to me.
Like maybe it's because we're not politically aligned to their customer base. Like
maybe.
I don't know.
It could also be that they're the ones paying for this. You know, because Gardner is sort of.
This is Forrester, though. Forrester.
Forrester. Oh, you're right. This is Forrester, not Gardner. I'm confused.
Yeah.
I mean, you pay for Forrester too, so you were right in context. Just
trying to. Who's C3 AI?
C3 AI.
They're in the leader group too, and I've never even heard of them.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Google was in the leader, Databricks in the leader, and SAS was all in leader. And then strong performers, IBM, Dataiku, AWS, Microsoft, and DataRobot. And then contenders, Cloudera, Altair, Domino Data, H2O.ai, which I've never heard of. And so, this is a bunch of companies I never heard of in a lot of ways, but you know, in the area of Google, which is what we're talking about, apparently Google is the best positioned hyperscaler for AI. Take that, Azure. Google Vertex AI is thoughtfully designed to simplify access to Google's portfolio of AI infrastructure at planet scale, AI models, and complementary data services. The company continues to outpace competitors in AI innovation, especially in Gen AI. No one tell Gemini that. And has a strong roadmap to expand tooling for multi-role AI teams. So, interesting. Check that out if you want to. There's a link to a reprint of the entire Forrester Wave if you want to read all the details, which we cannot talk about here because they're copyrighted. Good to know that there's a leader quadrant for this.
Okay, so C3 AI, I haven't actually done any research, but their stock symbol is just AI. I think they win.
They win.
Hands down, they win. Like, game over. Everyone else should just not be in the leaderboard.
I'm a little like, when did the IPO? C3. AI hasn't been that big for that long. December 2020. Wow. That's early. That's an early investor right there if you got into that one.
Well, if you look at it, they IPO'd and we're at like 150, and now they're at like 20s to 30s.
So maybe you lost your shorts.
Yeah. Not really the best time to invest in them.
They opened at 42 a share, so on their IPO.
So, and it looks like for a couple months they were in like the 150-ish range, 130 range, and then just downhill after.
Perfect. That's great. I don't know anything they do, so apparently it didn't hit the market. Google Cloud is extending their open platform with the preview of BigQuery's new integration with Anthropic Claude models on Vertex AI. That connects to your data in BigQuery with powerful intelligence capabilities of Claude models. BigQuery's integration with Anthropic Claude models allows organizations to reimagine data-driven decision-making and boost productivity across a variety of tasks, including things like analyzing log data, which is the worst use case of AI, marketing optimization, document summarization, and content localization. And if Jonathan was here, not sleeping and napping, he would tell you that Claude's pretty darn good. And so this is actually pretty nice to get an alternative that's pretty decent to Gemini to give you some additional BigQuery options for your summarization and advanced login analytics, apparently.
Yeah, he's been talking that up quite a bit. And we were going over a couple of things that he's been playing with just at his house, you know, and it's pretty great to, you know, some of the results he's getting and some of the things that he's finding new and interesting ways to use it on, which is kind of neat. So it's definitely something I definitely look forward to trying, and I keep getting inspired by some of that, and then my laziness takes over.
You mean your other 1,000 things you have to do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Laziness, 10,000 things doing, roughly the same.
Well, it's the laziness of hobby projects. It's we're all good workers. We have no time because we're, you know, to do any of the fun, lazy projects we'd like to do.
I have 11 in-flight projects, and I started writing them down because I was realizing that I can't start one without finishing another one, and it was just getting out of control. And so 11 is a low.
My favorite Jason Calacanis quote, starting is easy, finishing is hard. All right. For those of you who are using GCP observability tooling, they're introducing log scopes for cloud logging, a significant advancement in managing and analyzing your org's logs. So you don't need that fancy cloud thing. Log scopes are a named collection of logs of interest within the same or different projects. They are groups of log views that can control and grant permissions to a subset of logs in a log bucket. And combined with the metric scopes, log scopes let you define a set of correlated telemetry for your application, which can then be used for faster troubleshooting or referencing of insights. Some example use cases to help you understand how to use this. Correlating metrics with logs from the same application when an organization uses a centralized log storage architecture. Or use case number 2, correlating metrics with logs for isolated environments such as development, staging, and production across various projects.
Yeah, that second one is the one I'm most interested in just because it's, you know, for all kinds of reasons, we've separated workloads out and put them into different projects and for blast radius and for security concerns and all those things, but it becomes much more challenging to sort of correlate a transaction through many, many different services spread out through multiple projects. And so there's sort of two ways you tackle that. One is reconsolidate all the logs together. And that can get expensive and sort of generate a, you know, this condition where you're sorting through a whole bunch of noise. Or, you know, it's like you just look it up everywhere and you sort of manually construct it back together, which just doesn't work and no one does. That's what we used to do when all the logs were on server hard disks. So this is really neat to be able to sort of tag them all together really, and then sort of search on them from that tag, which I think is pretty neat.
Or you could go the terrible route and use Elasticsearch. How you felt about that, right?
You had to bring it out there.
I had to do it. It's too easy.
It's just mean, really. It's just, why would you do that? Like, we're having a good time. I'm sad.
Because we started so late, that I'm a little bit annoyed at everyone.
All right, let's move on to happier things. Google is enhancing Google Cloud Backup NDR services with some new capabilities this week. First, there's a new backup vault storage feature, which delivers immutable and indelible backups, securing your backups against tampering and unauthorized deletion, which is basically word for don't let your hackers delete your backups. Mm-hmm. A centralized backup management experience, which delivers a fully managed end-to-end solution, making data protection effortless and supporting direct integration into resource management flows. And finally, integration with Compute Engine VM creation experience, empowering application owners to apply backup policies when VMs are initially created. All good quality of life improvements. Mm-hmm.
The backup policy specifically when VMs are created is definitely something that, you know, I would like to see more features in that direction. Typically your backup policies tend to be, you know, just a big hammer approach to everything, and that gets expensive and difficult to manage. And if you have to audit on the compliance of your backups, then it becomes more complicated there. And so separating that out to where each application business owner and distinguish, you know, what their policy is and what their application actually needs, I think is great.
And even the first item about like the storage and everything, you know, AWS came out with it a few weeks ago in a similar model, but it really just helps a lot of the compliance and audit, and also trusting that, you know, your backups are there, they're not going to be touched, you know, and you are going to have them. So in an event that somebody does hose your entire account, this still will exist.
I'm still very afraid of using the indelible backups just because, like, what happens when I screw it up? And I always screw it up. Like, and I always have to start over.
Well, I mean, looking at the screenshots of the feature, it looks like you can indelible in the fact that you can say, like, I don't want to be able to delete them for 14 days or 365 mm-hmm. days, whatever the number is. So just wait till you know, after the number of days you set, and then you can delete it.
I don't know if you've met me, but remembering to do things 14 days later, that's not going to fit.
Yeah, that's true. 11 projects you said earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And that's down from like 20 some.
I feel like we need to give you like 10 post-it notes or something and just say these are the only post-it notes you can have. You can erase items on it. Mm-hmm. You can't add more.
Mm-hmm. We tried to get him just 3 projects, but that never worked out either. Because of him, because of me, but it's fine. All right, Azure. For those of you using the CLI, Azure is about to break something for you. With version 2.64 of the Azure CLI, the base Linux distribution of Azure CLI is now going to be Azure Linux and no longer Alpine Linux. There's really no impact to your AZ commands, but shell commands specific to Alpine will now break things like APK, which you might have needed to, you know, install modules, and GitHub Actions that use specific Alpine components or commands. You also have to trust that Microsoft Azure Linux is secure and as great as Alpine, which I have serious doubts about.
Yeah. No, that's like the whole reason Alpine exists is because it's so lightweight and, you know, easier to manage. And so that, you know, then you're use APK to tailor it exactly what you need. It doesn't have it otherwise. And I'm not familiar with Azure Linux, but I doubt it. Really doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically it's a slim version of Linux as well. So it is like similar. It's very similar to Alpine, but again, you have to change your GitHub actions, or you have to go change your commands you run in the shell script to non-Alpine ones now. And it breaks at this 2.64 version. So I'm not sure how the upgrade of that happens, if that's something I have to manually do, but I'd try to pin that version to 2.63. So I never have to deal with Azure this new Linux version.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand why they tried to, you know, build their own, another version of their own Linux. They already had their version, like, let's use what the community has versus build our own in this case.
Oh, I can tell you why. It's a supply chain problem. It's how they, you know, how do you tell the government that you're sure that nothing in your, you know, in your Linux operating system is compromised by a third party nation state? And the answer is, well, we own all of the source and we build our own version of Linux from that source and we review it all. And that's how you solve this problem.
So. I mean, there's so many ways that you have to validate that with, you know, like all the SALSA 3 checks for all the upstream dependencies.
You don't think Microsoft could do that? I bet Microsoft
could do it or does do it.
No, that's 2 different questions. Yeah. I think they could do it.
I think everyone could do it, but it's hard and annoying.
Do you trust them to do it? Third question.
Well, I think it's more about their trust, right? Like they're not trying. It's not really the consumer trust, because it's the same sort of problem if you're running on Alpine. It's more of what Azure can attest to.
Doesn't Red Hat have a small version of Linux too?
Yeah, most of them do now because Alpine got so popular, right? And then Docker.
Right.
Docker
would Alpine's based on Ubuntu or Debian? I don't
remember. Yeah, it's been a while, but I think it's Debian.
I think it's Debian too. Well, good luck to you, Matt, as they break your CLI. Look forward to hear complaints on that.
It's not the first thing they're going to break. Alpine's based on Gentoo.
Oh, Gentoo.
Really?
I like Gentoo. Yeah. I'm a little bit of a masochist, though, but I like Gentoo. It was the first Linux distro I learned. You want to talk about learning Linux the hard way?
Ooh, that is
yeah.
My first internship, I was given a computer. It said, go install Gentoo from a stage 3 bundle. Good luck.
Oh,
I learned a lot real fast.
Yeah. I think my first one was Linux Mandrake. I bought it a CD at Fry's. It was cool. Brought it home. Installed a bunch of stuff. Didn't work. Had to figure it out. Hack the kernel and make the drivers work. It's terrible.
Welcome to Gentoo. Yeah, if you're really, if you don't use Gentoo,
I mean, basically all Linux back in the 90s was difficult.
So, yes.
Unless you had a computer perfectly built with exact specifications, if you're going to run Linux on it with drivers, like you were hosed.
Yeah. You're going to have to put some sweat equity into that for sure.
Good litmus test for like hiring people. Like, hey, you think you're good at computers? Good. Get Linux working on this box that has incompatible hardware. Good luck to you.
And the only passing answer is no.
Yeah.
It was just installing all the flags on Gentoo, and then if you missed a flag, you had to recompile everything.
Yeah.
And then, God forbid, you wanted to recompile Open. What was it? OpenOffice back in the day before they became LibreOffice. That took at least 12 hours. By itself, so you just kissed everything you were doing goodbye.
It's all good productivity play. Mm-hmm. Well done, Gentoo.
Yes, it's compiling. I'm just thinking of the XKCD.
You guys got a lot farther than I did. I was just trying to do like Wi-Fi NIC drivers. That was where I got stuck.
Yeah, Wi-Fi NIC drivers is a pretty common one. Other one that video X. card drivers typically get you messed up with X and X windows. That was always a disaster. That's why I learned to love the command line and VM and Vim. I'm like, screw the GUI. No one needs that crap.
No one needs it. Why do you want to try to figure out how to make X work? Oh, you want two screens? Really good luck now.
Yeah. Screw that noise. Like I didn't figure out the mathematics of my screen. Like how many pixels? Why? Like,
Nope.
All right. Let's move on to other things. Azure AI Content Safety has two announcements for us this week. First is the general availability of prompt shields in the Azure AI Content Safety and Azure OpenAI service, which was introduced in 2024. Prompt shields seamlessly integrate with Azure OpenAI service content filters and are available in Azure AI Content Safety, providing a robust defense against different types of prompt injection attacks. And by leveraging advanced machine learning algorithms and natural language processing, prompt shields effectively identify and mitigate potential threats to user prompts and third-party data. And the second announcement this week is the inclusion of a filter that detects potentially violated copyrighted data. Many customers and users are apprehensive about the risk of IP infringement from AI. And to address this, the feature specifically targets model completions and scans for matches against an index of third-party text content to detect the usage of third-party text content, including songs, news articles, recipes, and selected web content, which is appreciated. But like, man, every day so much content gets created on the web. I don't know how you keep that up to date.
Oh, I mean, it's not really for its accuracy. It's about its mitigation of risk when you get sued. Because like you can say, well, I tried. I turned all the checkbox.
And that's a lot of what this is. Even the first one, the prompt injection, you know, as my day job has added some LLM features to our product or features that are based on LLM, there's a lot of questions from internal people, external people, clients, etc., that are all wondering how are we securing, what are we doing around this to make sure that, you know, we have proper controls in place. So being able to then point your finger saying we're using all the Microsoft features that they have, you know, is going to be a really nice way to say we're doing everything we can. It's evolving so fast. There's only so much we can do type of thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think that these types of features where it's built in, like, are going to be, it'll be in every product eventually, because I do think it's necessary, right? It'll be like, you know, managed web access firewall rules, right? It's, you can write your own rules, but then you can also subscribe and sort of use the default ones, and which do catch a ton of stuff. And so, like, you think about, you know, the early days of AI when everyone was trying to get out of the AI, like, sort of model, like, you know,
everyone was trying to break the model.
Yeah, break the model, or you know, like, get it to tell you data that it shouldn't have, and that kind of thing. And so, like, having this sort of be click box and just a configuration item is great. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't replace security. It just, it's an augment and accelerator.
It's add-on. You still have to do your general due diligence to try to make it, you know, protect it yourself. And this is a good add-on. It's a belt and suspenders model. And pricing of it's not great, crazy, but not horrible.
Yeah. I mean, Cloudflare, we talked about when they announced their similar prompt shield capability in their solution. So, you know, it's good that this is coming into the cloud native side too, but they can sell the Cloudflare option too. If you need multiple providers and multiple AIs are using the backend, they can filter all of that. Microsoft has released the third version of the M series, powered by fourth generation Intel Xeon processors or Sapphire Rapids across the board. These high memory VMs give customers faster insights, more uptime, lower total cost of ownership, and improved price performance for the most demanded workloads. And what were those, you might ask? SAP HANA, of course, because who else needs that much memory? Systems can scale workloads from 6 terabytes to 16 terabytes of memory with up to 40% throughput over the MV2 high memory, which is the old one. You can get 416 vCPUs with 6 terabytes of memory and a max of 64 data disks for the smallest. And the largest configuration includes 832 vCPUs and 16 terabytes of memory. Again, all that spot instance capacity right there for you.
Yeah, exactly.
One day I'm just going to launch one of these, you know, 30 terabyte, you know, servers just for fun. And
make sure it's your last day.
It can do stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be like, it would be so anticlimactic because it'll just run and, you know, no lights will dim. There's being no weird, like, noises. And then you'll try to use it and it'll just work. And then you'll be like, eh. Because getting a workload that can stress test this is hard, right? Like, it's, you can build stuff for sure. SAP has done a great job. But yeah, it's annoying.
I just still remember when the X1 instances were launched. I think they were like 2 terabytes or something. And I was like, oh my God. And now this is like 30 terabytes of memory. It's like its own level of crazy.
I mean, especially since I've spent the last like 10 years really chasing developer teams going, you don't really need 8 gigabytes. You
know? Yeah. Until you launch Windows. But you, besides that, you don't really need 8 gigabytes. Please don't use 8 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have Oracle stories this week.
Oracle.
I know.
I think
Oracle says that now is an exciting time to be developing AI and ML solutions. With investors and customers expecting AI and ML innovation at a dizzying pace, companies struggle moving from AI proof of concepts to production workloads. But the issue quite often being the efficient handling and preparing of massive amounts of data, a critical step that bottlenecks everything else in the development process. So Oracle is pleased to share breakthrough technologies like Scream on OCI to improve the outcomes by transforming legacy processes by accelerating the data preparation and reducing development cycles by over 90%. With these advancements, organizations can streamline their data workflows and expedite AI deployments, ultimately enabling them to achieve the strategic objectives more effectively. They talk about data preparation being, you know, something very labor-intensive, with manual processes that are time-consuming, prone to errors, and often require multiple iterations from manual scripting for data collection to painstaking efforts in data cleaning, and complex custom scripting for integrating and transforming disparate data sets. I clearly have seen my data model. Manual processes can lead to significant delays. So Scream on OCI dramatically impacts these tasks, streamlining and automating the process by leveraging GPU accelerator technology, as well as giving data scientists ability to quickly experiment with different feature sets and validate their effectiveness faster. Scream on OCI revolutionizes your team dynamics by enhancing collaboration, boosting morale and productivity, and optimizing human resource allocation, which I love to be considered human resource allocation. Really appreciate that. Scream also optimizes your hardware utilization, leading to reduced operational costs.
We should have you read that again. And every time you say Scream, we go, oh!
Yeah. Like, how do you say it? It's SQ, like SQL, and then Ream. So Scream.
I think it's Scream. Yeah.
I think it's Scream. Yeah. I just really struggled to take this article seriously because every time you said Scream, I would just wanted my head and wanted to go, ah!
Yeah. I also think that every one of their claims is complete nonsense. Like,
100%.
Because it's Oracle, and it's like, there's no way.
Like, I mean, sometimes you choose a topic for the, you know, you choose a show topic on here. You just have the scream opportunity for the show title of the show. So, you know,
I get it.
Yeah, it was, yeah, it's a little buzzword bingo, but.
Well, I mean, it's just, so like so many of their press releases in Oracle, like they're, you know, they're Unbreakable Linux. They have a very, I don't know, theme about them where it's like there's, and the promise is always there and then it never comes through. Like, I've never really been a big fan of the way that they advertise their service, the way they talk about their service, and then the reality of using them is sort of lackluster.
But 90%, Ryan, over 90%. Yeah, you don't need to read the rest of it. Just over anything over 90% just feels not accurate.
These labor-intensive manual processes that are all time-consuming and prone to errors. Yeah, you could just make an application and magically do that. No.
Well, I mean, it's all these things built in Oracle database. I mean, this is just a way to get your data out of Oracle database into other ML things faster. That's all it really is.
Yeah.
But
that makes sense.
Yeah, the thing about Oracle is everything goes back to the Oracle database somewhere, so they have to somehow get it back to Oracle so they can get more licensing out of you. That's the key. Well, Open World is actually happening this week, and they dropped a ton of announcements today that I said we're not going to cover those this week because I don't have that kind of patience to go through them.
I appreciate that.
But sometimes a story is so important that we must talk about it immediately, and that story happens in today. Folks, hell has not frozen over, nor are pigs flying, but Oracle and AWS have announced the launch of Oracle Database at AWS, a new offering that allows customers to access Oracle Autonomous Database Services within AWS Cloud. Oracle Database at AWS will provide customers with a unified experience between OCI and AWS, offering a simplified database administration, billing, and unified customer support case system. In addition, customers will be able to seamlessly connect enterprise data in their Oracle Database to apps running on EC2, AWS Analytical Services, or AI ML services, including Bedrock. With direct access to Oracle Exadata database services on AWS, including Oracle Autonomous Database on dedicated infrastructure and workloads running on rack clusters, Oracle Database AWS allows customers to bring together all their enterprise data to breakthrough innovations. Which I'm kind of, you know, like, I guess the days of Jassy poking the finger at Oracle on stage are over officially now. Yeah. I do have a couple quotes here, one from Larry Ellison and one from Matt Garman, CEO at AWS. Larry says, "We are seeing huge demand for customers that want to use multiple clouds. To meet this demand and give customers the choice and flexibility they want, Amazon and Oracle are seamlessly connecting AWS services with the very latest Oracle database technology, including the Oracle Autonomous Database. With Oracle Cloud infrastructure deployed inside of AWS data centers, we can provide customers with the best possible database and network performance." And Matt Garman had to say, "As far back as 2008, customers could run their Oracle workloads in the cloud, and since then, many of the world's largest and most security-sensitive organizations have chosen to deploy their Oracle software on AWS. This new, deeper partnership will provide Oracle database services within AWS to allow customers to take advantage of the flexibility, reliability, and scalability of the world's most widely adopted cloud alongside enterprise software that they rely on." And that was in the Oracle press release, by the way, that he got away with saying that.
Yeah.
Is impressive. Customers can also benefit from other things from the Oracle database at AWS offering, including zero ETL integration between the Oracle database and AWS analytics services, flexible options to simplify and accelerate migrating your Oracle database to the cloud, simplified procurement experience via the AWS Marketplace that enables customers to purchase Oracle database services directly through the Marketplace, and including bring your own licensing and discount programs such as Oracle Support Rewards, a fully unified support experience for both AWS and Oracle, as well as guidance through reference architectures, and seamless integration with the Amazon Simple Storage Service S3 for an easy and secure way to perform database backups and restores and to aid with your DR needs.
Wow.
After these features already existed between just RDS Oracle and AWS, I feel like.
That's true. They did.
And the other half, just use our good way to kill all your EDP pricing, EDP that you have to finish by the end of the year.
Well, I assume that contract that Amazon had made with Oracle back in forever ago had just expired. So that's what's driving this, or was like, because this is a, like, you know, why would AWS do this? The first question.
It's a rev share situation. They get. You know, you could basically, customers who are on AWS, you want to run their Oracle workloads beyond just the Oracle database. And that could be people using Oracle Financials or Marketo or all the other products they own. Not Marketo, I don't remember the marketing product. But they can now get access to those things because they're now on a supported version of Oracle, because Oracle didn't necessarily certify those products on Oracle RDS. So that's what you're getting here, is basically you're getting a fully supported Oracle offering if you're buying other Oracle application software things. And Oracle's going to take care of it for you, which is even better.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I understand why customers are going to love this, right?
Because oh yeah,
it's this has been a challenge because so many services are backed by Oracle databases, and support is always a nightmare if you're not running on a supported thing. And you know, then if you're even if you are running your Oracle workload in OCI, you're trying to use AWS services for it, you're paying for egress and all this craziness. And so this is fantastic, you know, for the customer set. I'm just still like good on Amazon because they're, you know, they have everything to lose in this. And, you know, hopefully I don't think it's gonna be like a revenue gaining thing, but they are gonna make customers happy, which is cool.
Very good. All right, that's it for this week. Like I mentioned, next week, tune in for a bunch of Oracle stuff. I assume, you know, this morning they dropped like 35 announcements and I was like, yeah, that's not happening on record day. And then, I assume they'll have a bunch more tomorrow and Wednesday before Oracle Open World closes out this week at reInvent. This week. There's actually a 1 o'clock interview with Lori and Matt on stage. So I'm going to check that out for next week. And then I'll be able to tell you what they said on stage and if they played nice or not. It'll be interesting to see.
I feel like it's going to be pre-written and they just have to like recite what they were told.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be just fine. There's no surprises on stage.
Yeah. It's like, it's a fireside chat, right? So, I mean, they can say whatever they want to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I believe.
Yeah.
I also could, sell you oil from Word Country. Anyways, that's it. I'll talk to you guys next week here at the Cloud Pod.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod.